This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Nick Miles, and at 13 hours GMT on Tuesday, the 22nd of October, these are our main stories. The US Secretary of State is in Israel pushing for a ceasefire in Gaza and Lebanon. We find out how the conflict in Ukraine is heightening tensions on the Korean Peninsula. And we'll hear the latest from Democrats and Republicans out on the campaign trail. Also in this podcast, as Elon Musk visits swing states.
I'm absolutely skeptical. He is part of this like upper 1% echelon of people. At the same time, a lot of what he was saying did seem like it came from a place of care.
The controversial business of a billionaire giving away millions of dollars, which critics say is an attempt to influence the US election. We start this podcast with the latest visit by the US Secretary of State to the Middle East. There have been optimistic discussions of a ceasefire over the past 12 months, but now Antony Blinken has touched down in Tel Aviv to a much more downbeat dialogue. The chances of a ceasefire in Gaza look slim, though. Israel's Benjamin Netanyahu says he'll continue waging war until Hamas is crushed. On another of the fronts in the conflict, Lebanon, Israeli military strikes have continued overnight in parts of Beirut. Health officials say 13 people died when a missile hit near the country's largest hospital. This man is still looking for one of his relatives.
I have a brother who's still under the rubble. His mobile phone is ringing. We are trying to search for him, but there is no way for a machine to get here. No one can help us pull him out.
We'll hear from our correspondent in Israel next, but first a picture of what's happening in and around Gaza from our international editor, Jeremy Bowen. We, along with other independent journalists, are not allowed into Gaza to report. So this is what Jeremy managed to gather from Israel.
Northern Gaza just after an airstrike from a vantage point a few miles away in Israel. It's a public holiday here. This is a popular place to observe the war. Israelis believe the killing and hostage taking by Hamas and the way Palestinians voted for them makes the war in Gaza and the others that followed necessary and just.
If they would return the hostages, then I would have what to feel for it. In the meantime, there's nothing I can feel for them.
A short drive away, close to the Gaza border, it was a family day out for Israelis who believe the war has given them the chance to recreate a very different Gaza. They want to restore Jewish settlements inside the Gaza Strip that the Israeli government removed in 2005. These people know what they want when eventually there's a ceasefire in Gaza. The Israeli government has only really said what it doesn't want. It doesn't want any kind of governance that looks like progress towards a Palestinian state. Now, that is a problem for its Western allies, the Americans, the British and others, because they believe a Palestinian state alongside Israel is the only way to stabilize the region and not have perpetual war. Anita Toker brought her family up on a farming settlement in the Gaza Strip. For her, leaving was a gross injustice. I played her a report I did about her departure 19 years ago.
This is an integral part of the state of Israel.
Since that day in 2005, they've dreamt about a return. And now they see Palestinians forced out of large areas of Gaza and are pushing to replace them.
I think we have an opportunity to build much more than we had before. I think we should build cities in some of the places. We should bring many, many more of Israel's population into the Gaza Strip. I think those people in the Gaza Strip, and there are a lot, that want to leave. Why is Egypt and Israel not allowing them to leave and go to Europe?
The bomb shelters where Israelis fled from Hamas have been made into memorials to the dead and to the hostages. This is where many were cornered and killed. The war is changing the Middle East in ways no one fully understands yet, and it's widening and escalating.
Jeremy Bowen, so what is Mr. Blinken specifically hoping to achieve, and how optimistic is he about succeeding? Our correspondent in Jerusalem is Jonah Fisher.
I think it's important to put this in the context of why this diplomatic mission has taken place, and it was to a significant extent, because last week after the killing of Yahya Sinwar, it was felt that there might be a window of opportunity, particularly in Western capitals and in the United States, for a renewed push for peace. The last couple of days, we've seen pretty clearly from the Israeli military that they still have objectives which they want to achieve both in Gaza and in Lebanon. So that has receded. Obviously, if one is to talk about some sort of ceasefire exchange and an exchange of hostages, that is complicated by the fact that the Hamas leadership has obviously been largely destroyed in Gaza itself. It's very unclear as to who would be the key people to negotiate with at this point. So I think what Blinken will be looking to do when he meets with the Israeli Prime Minister here will be to perhaps look beyond the immediate desire for something to do with hostages and a ceasefire, and to try and progress discussions on what Gaza might look like after some sort of deal, what sort of governance might be in place, who would run Gaza effectively when the war ended, who would be in charge of security arrangements, because Israel has made it very clear that they do not want Hamas to be that administration in Gaza, but we've not really had it spelled out as to what they would like to be there instead. So that is something which is likely to be discussed. I think probably the most achievable objective that may be on the table when these talks take place is humanitarian access. In the last week or two, we've had repeated calls from the United Nations for more aid to be allowed into Gaza, particularly the northern part of Gaza, where Israel has been focusing some of its efforts. So it may be that is one deliverable, let's say, that could come out of these talks today between Blinken and Prime Minister Netanyahu.
Now, this is Mr. Blinken's 11th visit since the Hamas attacks on Israel last year. Are there any indications, do you think, coming from the government in Israel that they're willing to make some kind of compromise over a ceasefire?
It's hard to see it if there is one. One has to be pretty clear about that. The message from the Israeli government is that things are going well, and that there's no doubt that they feel that they're on something of a roll in terms of killing the leaders of Hamas and Hezbollah. I think the sense one gets when you hear their public pronouncements, at least, is that they feel that this is a moment to push harder and to keep on with their military objectives rather than to look for peace at this point in terms of those negotiations. So if there is any sign that they're looking for a way to stop this at the moment, I haven't seen it.
Jonah Fisher. The leaders of the world's top emerging economies have been arriving in the western Russian city of Kazan for a three-day meeting as President Vladimir Putin hosts a summit for the so-called BRICS countries that include China, India and South Africa. Our Russia editor Steve Rosenberg is covering the meeting in Kazan, east of Moscow. So how important is this event?
I think for the Kremlin leader, it's very important. This is about optics. If you go back to February 2022, when Putin ordered the full-scale invasion of Ukraine, Western leaders vowed to isolate him. They dubbed him a pariah. We saw all those international sanctions that were announced against Russia. This week, we're going to see Vladimir Putin shaking hands with more than 20 heads of state, sitting around the table. The message he will send, therefore, to his own people and to the wider world is that he's not isolated at all. There are plenty of countries, nations, world leaders who are prepared to sit down and do business with him. So in terms of optics and symbolism, it's important. But substance too. The BRICS is a group of countries, emerging economies, that see themselves as a kind of counterweight to a Western-led world, challenging the sort of political and economic dominance of more advanced Western economies. And I think Vladimir Putin sees BRICS as a tool, an instrument to help shape a new global order. So I think the Kremlin will be pushing this week BRICS members, BRICS colleagues, to try to agree on a new cross-border payment system that doesn't depend on the US dollar. Whether he's successful in doing that is another question. This is not a grouping of like-minded souls, right? If you look at the original BRICS members, India and China, there are big differences between India and China. Amongst the new BRICS members, like Egypt and Ethiopia, there are tensions there too. Iran and Saudi Arabia, traditional our traditional rivals in that region. And, you know, Russia is motivated very much by anti-Western sentiment at the moment. Compare that with India, also a BRICS member, but a country that wants to maintain good political and economic relations with the West. So although Vladimir Putin will be keen to put across a show of unity with this group and declare that this group represents the global majority, after all, BRICS members make up about 45% of global population, there are differences of opinion and even animosity amongst the members.
Steve Rosenberg. China has confirmed that it's reached an agreement with India about how the two militaries patrol part of their disputed border after decades of tension. Beijing's foreign ministry spokesman Lin Jian said the two sides would work to implement the solution.
China and India have been in close communication recently through diplomatic and military channels on issues related to the China-India border. Now, the two sides have reached resolutions on relevant matters which China speaks highly of. Going forward, China will continue to work with India to implement these resolutions properly.
It is now 2 weeks before the US presidential election, with polling suggesting that it is a very tight race. With just a few thousand votes in the swing states expected to decide who wins, Donald Trump and Kamala Harris have been ramping up their efforts to reach beyond their party's traditional supporters. Mr. Trump is trying to woo black and Latino voters, and Kamala Harris is attempting to distance herself from President Biden's campaign. Let's hear now from campaigners in two of the swing states. Debbie Patel, who's been on the streets of Wisconsin for Kamala Harris and the Democratic Party.
People are just getting to know her. And because the vice president doesn't always have as visible a role, people want to know what her positions are. I think the things that the voters are most interested that we hear about is, as you probably know, a woman's freedom over her body is a huge deal in America, that the Trump and his MAGA colleagues want to control the bodies of one half of our population. They're very concerned about healthcare protections. They are concerned about whether they might lose Social Security. There is a concern about whether our families are safe. So those are the issues that we find the voters want to talk about.
Meanwhile, Melanie Collier, a Republican, has been canvassing for the Trump campaign in the swing states of North Carolina and her home state of Georgia. Here is what she told Michelle Hussein.
Right now, the people that I talk with are seeing what has happened with our economy. They see what has been the result of the last 4 years of the Biden-Harris administration. And she was very much an active part of what took place during these 4 years. And we're in some of the worst shape we've been in years and years and years. And they want Trump back because they want to go back to what his policy stood for and what they basically their way of life while he was in office. So right now, it doesn't take much to talk somebody into voting for Donald Trump right now.
The Harris-Biden campaign presidency had to bring the economy back from COVID, of course.
You can say that, but that's really minor compared to what the things that were in place when they came into office and the orders that Biden did the minute he walked in and just basically rescinded everything that Donald Trump had in place that was working. He destroyed. And so in the process, he and Kamala Harris have destroyed the economy. They're working really hard to destroy the whole country.
The world's richest man, Elon Musk, has come out strongly in favor of Donald Trump. And a move he made in swing states has been making headlines around the world. He said he'll give away $1 million every day until the US election on November the 5th to people in those states who sign his petition supporting Mr. Trump. The move has raised questions about its legality. From Pennsylvania, a swing state where Kamala Harris has been polling slightly ahead, and Elon Musk recently visited and gave out a $1 million check, our North America correspondent, Nora Torfik, reports.
It's not often that the world's richest man travels to small-town Pennsylvania and gives out $1 million for signing a petition.
You're most welcome.
In the final sprint of the election, Elon Musk has doubled down on his commitment to get Donald Trump elected, with town halls and these giveaways to turn out voters in this swing state, which is a must-win for both candidates.
This election, I think, is going to decide the fate of America, and along with the fate of America, the fate of Western civilization.
His speeches are filled with stark warnings that Trump is the only one who can save democracy. It's inevitably led to two questions. Will it work? And why is he doing it?
I'm right outside Ridley High School where Elon Musk spoke. And right across the street is a pretty quiet neighborhood. So they don't really discuss politics, they tell me. In fact, residents were surprised that Elon Musk chose here of all places to come. But some do believe he could have an impact on this election.
And like I said, I'm an undecided voter still.
Xander Mundy was in the middle of his typical workday when his boss told him that Elon Musk was speaking at a school nearby in Folsom, Pennsylvania, and they should all drive by. The 21-year-old wasn't even planning on voting, but left the event considering Donald Trump.
Someone like that tells you this is the election that's going to decide our future. This is going to decide not only who's president for the next 4 years, but what our world is going to be like, what the Western world is going to be like. And I think that's pretty huge, you know, that matters.
Are you at all skeptical, though, about Elon Musk's motivations?
Yeah, I'm absolutely skeptical. He is a multi-billionaire. He is a part of this like upper 1% echelon of people. And again, I don't agree with all of his views. But at the same time, a lot of what he was saying did seem like it came from a place of care.
If former President Donald Trump wins, Elon Musk will have his ear and therefore a potentially strong influence on decision making in the White House. At his town halls here in Pennsylvania, Musk repeated how he will lead a Department of Government Efficiency, while targeting government regulations could benefit Musk's businesses.
Musk moved Tesla's headquarters from California to Texas in protest of California-style regulation.
Eric Gordon is the chair of the Entrepreneurship Department at the University of Michigan's Ross School of Business.
He wants to be sort of an on-the-frontier, wild and woolly entrepreneur who can break new paths and not be bogged down by regulation. And, you know, regulation in all governments tends to fall 5, 10, 20 years behind the advances in technology. You know, Musk wants it to go the other way. He wants to go to Mars.
Lawrence Noble, a former general counsel with the Federal Election Commission, is among those who have questioned the legality of Musk's million-dollar giveaway. He says the billionaire style should concern anyone that values safe work environments and consumer protections.
We know what companies do when left to their own devices. They put profit and stockholder value and CEO compensation above safety. And they kind of write off the safety issues as a cost of doing business. And it's dangerous to have somebody who views business that way and views government that way in charge of safety.
We have liftoff.
Elon Musk relishes being a disruptor, and there's no question that he's achieved extraordinary feats in rocket science and EV technology. That's why his mutually beneficial relationship with the U.S. government will continue no matter who is president. But his brand and reputation is now tied to Donald Trump's. And by his actions, he knows it.
Neda Torfik. Still to come in this podcast.
Life was not only resilient, but it like actually, you know, it bounced back really quickly and then it thrived.
How Earth came back from a meteor strike that boiled the oceans. The front lines in the Ukraine conflict may well be 7,000 kilometres from the Korean Peninsula, but that hasn't stopped the two nations there from getting involved. After allegations that Pyongyang is preparing to send troops to fight alongside Russian forces, Seoul says it will take countermeasures. South Korea's Deputy National Security Advisor Kim Tae-hyo made the announcement at a news conference following a meeting of the National Security Council.
The government urges the immediate withdrawal, and if this illegal cooperation between North Korea and Russia continues, the government will not stand by, and it will respond in a firm manner with the international community.
Our Asia-Pacific editor, Mickey Bristow, told us more.
North Korea simply denies the fact that it's sending troops to Russia. What we know all comes from South Korea, which monitors very closely what goes on in North Korea. And South Korea says that North Korea is preparing to send 12,000 elite troops to fight with Russia in Ukraine. 1,500 of those, it says, are already in the Russian Far East. Some might be in Ukraine already. Russia hasn't said anything about this. The Americans haven't added anything either. So we're just relying on what the South Koreans say. They've also, in South Korean news media, have kind of published a photograph showing a North Korean flag flying alongside the Russian flag on the battlefront. So little bits of evidence coming out to suggest North Korea is sending troops to Ukraine to fight for Russia.
But why would South Korea be so concerned about that?
Yeah, it's a really good question because, as you mentioned in the introduction there, that it's a long, long way, the Korean Peninsula, from Ukraine. Why would South Korea be bothered? I think two reasons, really. One is that over recent years, South Korea has joined what might be termed the Western group of nations in believing international sanctions and the rule of law should be enforced. And so sanctions imposed on North Korea means this kind of interaction between North Korea and Russia will be illegal. But also, I think South Korea mainly is concerned about its own position. It has a very heavily fortified border with North Korea. It will be wondering if North Korea is sending these troops to Ukraine for Russia, what is it getting in return? It already says that North Korea is sending munitions to help the Russian fight in Ukraine, but what is it getting for all this? And might that tip North Korea's balance in its, South Korea's battle or its tension with North Korea? That's its main concern.
So what's Seoul's response been?
Well, Seoul has said it's going to have a phased response to what North Korea is doing. And interestingly, the most interesting aspect of what it was saying is that it could supply Ukraine with offensive weapons. Now, thus far, it's been supplying it with non-lethal aid, things like gas masks, field rations, things that can be used by the army, but essentially at guns and bullets, that kind of thing. But it's indicated that that might change. So, of course, this is a way that a local a rivalry between North Korea and South Korea could end up escalating the battlefield in Ukraine.
Mickey Bristow. Mozambique suffers from increasingly intense tropical storms. And those storms cause the destruction of many communities. And experts say it's made worse by deforestation because of logging. Now, a Gulf-based company, Blue Forest, says it's secured a contract to plant 200 million trees. As Jose Tembe reports, the Mozambique government says this will be the start of a much-needed regeneration.
This is the sound of strong winds blowing from the Indian Ocean onto Mozambique's coast. The country's 2,500-kilometre coastline is home to an extensive mangrove ecosystem, but in recent years it has been devastated by the twin effects of violent storms and deforestation. The loss of the mangroves is considered so worrying in Mozambique that even local musicians have joined the fight to save them. Musician Rosalia Mboa sings Preservação do Mangal, Preserve the Mangroves.
I wrote this song because I observed the devastation of mangroves and I'm asking people to stop.
To help improve the situation, the Mozambican government has awarded a license to the Gulf-based company Blue Forest. The company's founder and chief executive officer is Vaid Fotuli.
The core objective is to first restore the degraded areas that exist along that coastline, and which add up to about 30,000 hectares of degraded mangroves, and secondly, to conserve the standing mangroves that are there, which span across about 120,000 hectares.
Mozambican ecologist Carla Mahuman says that projects like this are essential not only to protect the coastline, but also the livelihoods of the people who live there.
De forma particular,
having a protected, well-maintained mangrove ecosystem means we'll have a rich diversity of trees and plants, as well as marine and river-dwelling creatures. This will benefit us economically, socially, and environmentally. We'll be healthier because the mangrove trees will absorb carbon dioxide and transform it into oxygen, which will give us a purer environment. At the same time, the mangroves will act as a nursery for both marine and bird species.
According to Mozambique's National Director of Climate Change, Jadwiga Masinga, this is the first of many projects the government hopes will not only restore the mangroves, but help coastal communities survive.
As a country that experiences effects of climate change, the project, which combines mangrove restoration with social and economic aspects, is very welcome. It is the first project approved for coastal area. There are over 40 another companies that are still in the feasibility study.
As Rosalia Mboa sings, preserving the mangroves is vital for both the wildlife and the people of Mozambique. The hope is that projects like this one will turn the tide against the loss of habitat and ensure future generations will thrive despite the changing climate on Mozambique's coast.
Jose Tembe reporting there. Well, Mozambique's problems have been exacerbated by climate change. And ahead of the UN Climate Change Conference, which gets underway next month, we're going to be recording a special edition of the Global News podcast. I'll be putting your questions to two of the BBC's top climate change experts. So if there's anything you want to know, such as the impact of conflicts on climate change, that was one person's question that has been sent in. Another has asked what pressure can be put on companies to meet their emissions targets. All these kind of things. If you want to know the answer, we'll put these questions to our experts. Send us an email to globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. And if you can, send it as a voice note. Thanks. Now, we know that the meteorite that wiped out the dinosaurs was very big. But now scientists at Harvard University in the US have discovered that there was one much, much bigger that hit the Earth 3 billion years ago. 200 times bigger, in fact. And it hit the Earth in what is modern-day South Africa. Harvard University's Professor Nadja Drabon explains what happened next.
Life was not only resilient, but it like actually, you know, it bounced back really quickly and then it thrived. You know, these big impacts would have been really rich in phosphorus, and phosphorus is an absolutely essential nutrient for life. The tsunami that swept across the globe would have brought a lot of iron-rich deep waters to the surface. And this iron is also really important for early microbes.
Our science reporter Georgina Rannard told us more.
Carrying backpacks and sledgehammers, these scientists are on their way to peer back in time to our planet's early years. Inside these rocks are the clues about what happened one violent day 3 billion years ago, when a meteorite careened into what is now South Africa. It made some other space rocks in Earth's history look tiny.
We don't know the exact shape of these meteorites, but the one that wiped out the dinosaurs was about 10 kilometres wide. That's just over the height of Mount Everest. But that was just a baby compared to this one. It was 4 to 6 times as wide and 50 to 200 times more massive. It was like a rock the size of Greater London smashing into Earth.
The impact tore up the seafloor, causing a tsunami likely bigger than any seen in human history. The oceans boiled from all the excess energy, and the skies turned black, filled with dust that stopped sunlight reaching life that needed it for energy. But the scientists also found something unexpected. On our young planet, life was still in simple single-cell form. But scientists now know that from the ruins of one fiery crash, life could bounce back and thrive.
Georgina Rannard. Ever since the war in Gaza erupted just over a year ago, following Hamas's October the 7th attack, hundreds of thousands of children have had little or any access to education. Schools have been shut and many have been turned into shelters for displaced people. Some have been badly damaged or destroyed by Israel's bombardments. They include Gaza's Edward Said Conservatory for Music. Our former Gaza correspondent John Donison, who visited the conservatory when it was still standing before the war, reports now on a new effort to teach music to young children.
In Gaza, amidst the mayhem, a moment of melody. For children, learning music is not easy at the best of times. And for Mohammed, playing the violin, these are the worst. The 14-year-old lost part of his arm in an Israeli airstrike.
It changes the atmosphere of the war, from what has happened to me and from what is happening. It changes the mood when I play the violin.
He and his teacher, Sama, have to improvise, carefully tying the violin bow to his elbow with a scarf.
He is a child who used to play the oud before he lost his hand during the school bombing. I wanted Mohammed to continue his dreams by teaching him music and helping him achieve what he couldn't before. I decided to teach him how to play the violin because it was difficult for him to play the oud.
And that's the instrument, like a Middle Eastern lute, that 10-year-old Abed al-Rahman is learning. He had to have part of his leg amputated.
We were living a life of bombing and shelling, and I was injured in my leg. When the teacher came, we started practicing on something new, and we learned. When we practice, we can express ourselves and feel relaxed in our hearts.
His teacher is 15-year-old Salah.
The children are very happy to experience something new, like musical instruments. They are excited and keep asking us to come every day.
Both Salah and Sama were students at the internationally renowned Edward Said Conservatory for Music in Gaza City, but it was bombed earlier in the war. Over the last few months, they've been teaching in three schools now turned into shelters for displaced children and their families. One of them is 11-year-old Lina.
It's a beautiful feeling because when the teachers come, they help us escape the state of the war we're living in.
After a year of war, for these traumatised children, music offers a rare chance to let their hearts sing.
John Donison reporting. And that's all from us for now, but there will be another edition of the programme later. If you want to comment on this podcast, just send us an email to globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. This edition was mixed by Nora Hull and the producer was Stephanie Prentice. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Nick Miles, and until next time, goodbye.